All right. Well, I'm Jan Jarbo Russell, and I'm the author of The Train to Crystal City. And I want to thank you very much for coming here. I know there is a lot to do tonight on Friday night, and I think Irene and I are thrilled that you're here. I'll tell you a little bit about how we're going to do this. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Crystal City internment camp, the secret camp in South Texas. And then I'm going to give a little description of what the camp was like. And then we'll get to the really jaw-dropping aspects of the book, and that is that this camp was the center of President Roosevelt's prisoner exchange program. And the surprise twist in the book is seated to my left, and those of you who are from Ann Arbor know that this is Irene Hassenberg Butter, and she was in the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp and was part of the exchange from Crystal City, from the children and people from Crystal City. And we'll describe that exchange. But then we'll talk at the end about what we have learned about citizenship and about statelessness and about how this keeps happening again and again and seems to be part of the nature of war. And then I'll let Irene say something about getting going, and then we'll get going.
Well, the first thing that I want to say, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Is that I learned a lot about my own life from Jan's book, things that I never knew before. For example, I did not know that I was part of a prisoner exchange, and I knew very little about the details. Now, of course, I was born in Berlin. My family moved to Holland to escape National Socialism and the persecution of the Jews. And my father happened to find out that you could write to a man in Sweden and send passport pictures. And if you're lucky, then you would receive passports. And we were already in the first concentration camp in Holland when the passports arrived, which itself was a miracle because we never received any forwarded mail. So the passports arrived. We were in Vesterbork, and this meant that we were no longer going to be deported to Auschwitz, because with these Ecuadorian passports, we were labeled exchange Jews. And the Nazis decided that a Jew alive was more valuable than a Jew dead when you were eventually going to exchange people for people. And they were very eager to get German citizens back from America and from all the American countries, South and Central America, where many, many Germans had gone early in the 20th century. So we had these passports. We were told that we would be going to America soon. And instead of being deported to Auschwitz, we were sent to Bergen-Belsen, a camp in Germany. And they told us, it will be a better camp, and you won't be there very long because you will be going to America. Well, almost 1 year later, when we barely survived, we were told that some people would be going out who had passports like ours, and they weren't just Ecuadorian, they were Paraguay and Honduras and many different countries, Argentina and whatnot. And we were told that some people with these passports would be leaving the camp, and you had to report to a doctor. He had to see you to find out if you were what they call transport fähig, that you were capable of being exchanged. And so this happened, and of many, many hundreds, several thousands, as a matter of fact, Jews in Bergen-Belsen with exchange passports, they selected 300. And 300 were going to go on a train. And we didn't know where because they never told you anything about where. But when we came to the train station, it was a Red Cross train. And that was the hint that we weren't going to be sent to another concentration camp if it was a Red Cross train. So this is how we became part of this prisoner exchange.
Yes. And it's, while all this is going up, in the run-up to the war, FDR's focus shifted from the New Deal to the war. And even after Hitler had invaded Poland in September 1939, polls showed that 90% of Americans did not want to go to war. They favored neutrality. But FDR was convinced we would be going to war, and in 1939, he set up this secret division within the Department of State called the Special War Problems Division to identify American civilians, diplomats, businessmen, journalists, missionaries who were living in Europe, primarily Germany and Italy, and the Far East, and who would be in danger in the event of war. And this, in 1939, his prisoner exchange policies went into effect. He asked this special war problems to prepare a plan to intern civilians who were Japanese and German, especially a few Italians who were living in the United States. So in 1939, the extent of his internment policies were really unknown until we got a lot of these records from the Special War Problems Division. He gave J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, broad powers to investigate the Japanese, German, and Italian immigrants who either because of their occupations or because of their leadership within these communities could be suspected of disloyalty. Eleanor Roosevelt was opposed to all of these things, but Franklin Roosevelt would wouldn't listen to her. And she, as most first ladies do, was forced to go along with it. When the novelist and humanitarian Pearl Buck wrote to Eleanor Roosevelt begging Eleanor Roosevelt to not evacuate all of these Japanese and Japanese Americans from the West Coast, Eleanor Roosevelt wrote back that while she regretted it, that the evacuation was necessary and that there was nothing she could do. So not even the great Eleanor Roosevelt could stop what happened. As you know, the roundup began as a result of Executive Order 9066, and most of us in this room are very familiar with the atrocity of the evacuation of 120,000 Japanese, two-thirds of them American-born from the West Coast. These pictures from Dorothea Lange are of the Fukuda family in San Francisco as they are being taken from their homes and put into this bus, and this woman is pregnant, and she will be going to the Santa Rita horse track where she will give birth to her son in a horse stall. And then she was later in the secret camp in Crystal City with her six sons and one daughter. I love this photo because it's like the face of, as Irene and I often talk about, the humanity of this situation. This is, it's almost like a Madonna and Child of the Japanese American culture, and this is his wife with her son. My book tells the story. The three main characters in the book are The Ingrid Isserol, who is sitting on that chair, and her mother, Joanna, her little sister, Inzi, and Lothar. And it was, these were the people that were sent from Crystal City at the last exchange, the sixth exchange from Crystal City. And so these are the people that Irene and her family were traded for. These are American-born children. Joanna and her husband, Matthias, came to the United States as legal immigrants in 1922 and were married. He was a very well-known engineer in the town of, near Cleveland, Ohio, and lived in Strongsville, Ohio. And under the terms of Hoover's Hoover's investigation, you were arrested as an enemy alien not because of anything you had done against that was disloyal to the country, but a lot of it was by your occupation. And the idea is if you were a photographer or an engineer or anything, or a leader in your community, then you were taken and you were arrested under the Enemy Alien Act of 1745 with no charges filed. And the terms of your internment were indefinite. They could on the day he was arrested in January, on January 8th, 1942, he was simply taken from the house, and they did not know where he was for many months. Joanna lost the house, and this picture was taken right before they moved into a public relief, essentially a home for people that were homeless in Strongsville. Ingrid had long, brassy red hair, and she always hated this picture because her mother had done a permanent on her the night before, and she always called this the unfortunate permanent picture. The second of my main characters was a Japanese family from San Francisco. This is Sumi in the middle with a little white dress on, and her father, Tom. Tom was a photographer in Los Angeles, and a very famous photographer in Los Angeles, and he too was arrested, and they were exchanged into Japan. I'm not going to talk as much about them tonight, but fully half of the camp in Crystal City was Japanese Americans, and the other half were Germans and 12 Italian families, and I could not find any living of Italian families that from this camp. I just want to run briefly through the camp so that you can understand what it was like. The camp opened in 1943, and the commandant of the camp was a man named Joseph O'Rourke, a Border Patrol officer from New York who was had a little drinking problem, and so they sent him far down to South Texas as far as they could go, and it worked out pretty well. One of the differences is that the commandant in Bergen-Belsen was this awful man named Joseph Kramer, right, who was known as the butcher of Bergen-Belsen. By a strong contrast, Joseph O'Rourke was known by the children of the camp, German Americans and Sumi and Japanese alike, as the Pied Piper, because he was so kind to the children of Crystal City. And so there were 4,000 people in Crystal City at the time that Sumi and Ingrid was there. There were 15,000 people in Bergen-Belsen at the time Irene was there. The camp was 290 acres, and here's an overview of it. I do it because sometimes when I talk to people and they've read my book, they say, I can't believe this happened, so I'm bringing the pictures so that you can see it did in fact happen. The guards on horseback, there were 10-foot barbed wire fences. There were 6 guard towers, and the armed guards on horseback surveyed the fence. On the right was the commandant of the camp, Joseph O'Rourke. The daily life in Crystal City was very highly regulated. People had to show up in the morning and show their faces for daily roll call. It wasn't anything, and Irene will talk about her life in Bergen-Belsen, but it wasn't anything as bad as Bergen-Belsen, but it was, they had lost their freedom. They had lost everything. They had lost their homes, their businesses. And these Japanese children are at play. And in Crystal City is located the very southern tip of Texas, 35 miles from the Mexican border. And it is 125 degrees in the summer there, and it's very hot all year round. And so most of the people that were in Crystal City came from the east and west coasts because that's where the leaders of the Japanese community and the German communities were from, and they were took the train to Crystal City and taken to these places. Sumi, who has a very good sense of humor, said that she didn't even believe it was a real place when they got in there. She had been in Heart Mountain, and she came to Crystal City, and she said there was tumbleweed rolling down the street, and she thought it was like a movie set. She didn't believe it was a real place until she soon found out it was. We're going to take questions at the end, if that's okay.
How much of this is left, if any?
There's not anything left. Sumi, there were three schools, an American school, which Sumi went to, and she was a yell and song leader, a German school that was taught by German internees where Ingrid went, and a Japanese school taught a lot. There were 250 Buddhist priests in the camp because the Buddhist priests were considered leaders of their communities. You know, and it was largely completely innocent people. There were a few people that were very difficult people. Fritz Kuhn, who was the head of the American Nazi Party, was in this camp, and he was a troublemaker. But by and large, most everyone here was an innocent person. There's Sumi. She was a Girl Scout. In the camp, the internees did all the work in the camp. This is the German side, the barbers and the beauticians. I just have some pictures. This is the Boy Scouts, and you will see that they are flying the Japanese flag. And under the terms of the Geneva Convention, if you're in an internment camp, you can fly the flag of your country, but it caused a lot of cultural problems within the camp. These are the Japanese women who were sewers and who made the mattresses, who made the clothes for the people, who made the dolls for the Japanese ceremonies, which occur. The doll ceremonies in the culture happen in March, and so this all happened. So, and the Japanese and the Germans were strictly segregated, because they didn't get along. And the Japanese, Rourke was remarkably good at working with the internees. And for instance, the Japanese people really missed having their own kind of food. And so he allowed them to build a tofu factory in a victory hut. And so we had what was surely the first tofu factory in Texas. It was at the internment camp there. But the Germans got mad about the fact that the Japanese had the tofu, so they said they'd like a beer hall. And so there it is, and there's some German fathers. So you see how nicely dressed they are, and once a week, they were allowed to brew some sort of beer, but I'm sure that was a rule that might have been overlooked sometimes a lot. So they had a huge swimming pool because it was so hot, and it used as an irrigation ditch, but it was also a lot of source of great tragedy in the camp. Two Japanese Peruvian girls who were at the camp. Died in the camp, and that was a very sad thing, and other sad things happened there, but it was the hangout for the children in the camp. To the best of their ability, Joseph O'Rourke tried to let the families be together. Each family had its own bungalow, nothing like what Irene will tell about the kind of conditions that she and her poor family lived in Bergen-Belsen. But oddly enough, that when I interviewed and listened to the witnesses from the child survivors in the camp, some of their best memories were in Crystal City, because even though they had lost their freedom, they were in very small quarters with their family. And unlike in Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz, even though the penalty for escape was death at Crystal City, and everybody was under constant armed guard and censorship and everything, even though all of that, they didn't lack for food, as Irene did. And so you have to. There is no such thing as a humanitarian internment camp, but I want to be very honest about what it was really like there as opposed to the concentration camps in Germany. But by far, The most jaw-dropping aspect of life at Crystal City was that it was the center of FDR's prisoner exchange program. In the course of the war, there were six large prisoner exchanges, some to Japan, especially early in the war, and then some to Germany. The exchange that involved the Isserol family and Irene was the very last exchange of the war. And I'd like to talk a little bit about what it was like from Ingrid and her family's point of view until Irene's train and Ingrid's trains met at Kreuzlinger. So what happened was that Ingrid and her family, I think I have a picture here. That's Ingrid after the war, when she came back to America. And so that's Ingrid there. But Ingrid was 15 when she left the camp on January 2nd, 1945. Irene was 14 in Bergen-Belsen. And she left, in the run-up to having to leave, she wore a new tag, and the tag said repatriate. Well, this was ridiculous language, because repatriate means that you're being returned to the country of your origin. And that would be true of her parents, Matthias and Joanna. But she and her brothers were considered repatriates, because they had to go with their parents back to Germany because they were part of the prisoner exchange program. And so at that moment, she was essentially a stateless person. Not even though she was born in America, she was in between countries. And there was a lot of discussion in the family bungalow about it. Joanna was pregnant. And there was some hope that she would be able to stay in Crystal City because she was 9 months pregnant. But the Border Patrol people and the Special War Projects people said no, and they put her on the train anyway. She was 9 months pregnant, and when they got to New Orleans, they had to bring doctors with them on the train because of these kind of things. So she gave birth to a boy, Gunther, as they were going into New Orleans. The doctor was such a nice man, Dr. Martin, that he offered to adopt the child because he knew that they were going. I mean, we were at the very end of the war. The Battle of the Bulge was going on as this was happening. But Matthias was a very strong-headed German guy, and he, of course, would not give up his son. They sailed. They boarded the Gripsholm at Jersey City. They took the train from Crystal City to the port of New Jersey. They boarded the boat. There were 183 German prisoners of war in this exchange and 856 civilians, which meant that number had to be negotiated in Berlin. And I did not know, but as Irene explained to me, that the Germans are very good at counting in numbers. And so I was able to get the list of people that were on that, that were the civilians, because Berlin had it. And the people at the archives told me that they should go to the Holocaust Museum. And I got the list of the 300 Jews, including Irene's family and another family that was still alive. And it was the Wolf family. And we have with us tonight Lori, who is the daughter of one of Irene's closest friends, Marie, otherwise known as Mika. And she too made it out. And Lori, will you stand just so that people know that both of these families are here? And so I'm very thrilled about that. So when Ingrid and them, they arrived, they sailed past the Gibraltar on the Big Rock on January 18th. They got into Marseille on January 21st. The Germans had bombed the port of Marseille, and so they had a lot of waiting because they had to get the the bombs out. And so they then, on the 24th or so, took French trains to Kreuzlingen. And that's when the exchange was made, when Ingrid and her family and the others left the jurisdiction of the United States and Switzerland and walked into Germany at the time that the people on the other side of the train, including Irene, including Marie and the other wolves, came in to freedom. And we're going to, and then at this point, I'll just say, and then I want to, if we could, for the purposes of the filming, take the questions at the end. It would make it better for the people who aren't here. But, and I'm sorry, but that's it. When Ingrid and her parents got there, they still had that Gunther guy, that little baby who was in dire trouble, and they started walking the 180 kilometers to Idstein. Their walk was very, very difficult. There was no food. Of course, they had been used to food, and it was very difficult. And along the way, a lot of the Germans, the real Germans, considered them spies because Ingrid and only spoke English, and so they got they were in for a lot of trouble. As they got near Frankfurt and were going to take a train to Idstein, they had a very terrible thing happen. 8 bombers, American bombers, P-38 bombers, dropped bombs on their train, and the train was stopped. And Ingrid and her brothers and sisters were fine. They had to get under the seat, but they were fine. But Joanna, who had always wanted to be an American, told Ingrid to think that American bombers, the people that I was with, I'm in the situation where they're bombing my children. It was a terrible irony. So they did make it. They made it to Idstein, and then I would like Ingrid to talk a little bit more about the difficulties. Those 300 Jews from Bergen-Belsen were, to my knowledge, the only Jews saved in these 6 trades. So, but they were dying at such a big rate because they were so starving, and I would like her to talk about the lice and the lack of food. And then that by the time that they got to freedom, I believe the actual number of people that were saved was 125. So it's a heartbreaking story. So you want to talk about how heartbreaking it was?
Well, Bergen-Belsen is. The situation in Bergen-Belsen is pretty well known. People died right and left, especially at the end of 1944, towards the time when we were liberated. And lice, epidemics, starvation, cruelty, torture, people being beaten up, hard labor, and everything combined just caused a very high death rate. So then we went to report to the physician. I think it was January 21st when there was an announcement that everybody who has a passport needs to report to this German physician. And we did. And then they said, get ready because... tomorrow, a train will leave. You're going on a train. And we had to go through a delousing process, which was totally ineffective because it incubated all the eggs in our clothing, and we had more lice afterwards than we did before. My brother always said if the Germans had been as inefficient in all their activities as they were in the delousing process, then things would have been a lot better for the Jews. But anyway, so we did get on the train, and I'll skip the details. And two days later, my father died on the train. And, of course, the Germans had come up with a certain number, so right away things started happening because he was the first one to die, but not the only one to die on this train. And so the train stopped in a town in southern Germany and took 48 Jews from Bergen-Belsen off the train, put them in an internment camp, and there were Americans, real Americans, in that internment camp, and then replaced them on our train for the Jews who were dying. So the composition of our train changed. They stopped a few other times, more times, at interning camps to recruit American citizens who had been interned there. So, well, the railroad tracks were bombed, so it took a number of days. But after my father died, and my mother was the one who had been seriously ill for several months, and my brother and I were worried about her dying, so when my father died, we were in complete shock. And then I wasn't conscious anymore, and I wasn't aware of what happened from there on with the exchange. So a few days later, there was this night in Kreuzlingen, which I learned from Jen's book, where there were two parallel trains, the train with the Germans from Crystal City and then our train. And what was so interesting to read in the book is that the Germans from Crystal City landed on this Swedish neutral ship called the Gripsholm in Marseille, which a number of years later, I was on a train to Marseille and I saw this gorgeous ship all lit up. We arrived there in the night. And up to that point, I had been under the impression that we were going to America, not knowing that our passports were invalid. And so actually, when we arrived in Switzerland, we didn't have any citizenship because Hitler took German citizenship away from all Jews. We immigrated to the Netherlands, but the Netherlands became occupied, and you can't get citizenship in an occupied country. So where were we going to go? No citizenship, no home. No place to go. So I saw this beautiful Gripsholm, but pretty soon I became aware that we weren't going to America. And we were shifted to an Italian freighter, a dumpy little Italian freighter. And only now, recently, I learned, because I've forgotten everything, that we were sitting in the harbor of Marseille for 5 days in this dumpy freighter, and we still didn't know where we were going. And then eventually the freighter took us to Algiers.
Where's that photo? Your photo.
North Africa. There was a camp, and it was administered by the UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Association.
That's you, right?
Yes, right, and that's me,
Marie, right. Who is Laurie's mother, and that is Jack, the grandfather,
and Jack next to him,
and Jack, her brother, Marie's brother next to them, and that's what they lived in at this camp at Philippeville. So, unfortunately, Marie's mother and Jack's mother died in this camp too, and so. But go ahead and explain about the camp in Philippeville.
So this was the camp. Of course, the housing was heaven compared to where we had come from, and it was up on a hill, and if you walked down the hill, you were right at the Mediterranean. There was a beautiful beach. We were fed 3 meals a day. We got some kind of clothing. And the question always was, what's next? But in the camp, Jack and Marie's father was a language teacher, so he started a school, and we got English lessons and French lessons, because now we were in a French-speaking country. And as time went on, the administration of the camp tried to figure out where these various people were going to go. It was a refugee camp, just as we hear a lot now in the news. I often identify with what's happening these days, because where do you go? And so some people had relatives all over the world. Some people went to Yugoslavia. Some Dutch people went back to Holland. There were people who had children in South Africa, so they went to South Africa. And quite a number of us had relatives in America. But there still was a quota, and it wasn't simple to come to America. So our relatives had to provide affidavits, and they had to come up with money for the fares. Meanwhile, my mother and my brother were in a Swiss hospital because my mother was dying when they took her off the train, and my brother had another medical problem. So they were in the hospital, and no matter how much I plead, I wasn't allowed to stay in Switzerland. The Swiss sent me along with all the other people. And so it took a couple of months before I even knew that my mother had survived when I received a telegram in March. And it took another month before we could exchange correspondence. But both my mother and my brother gradually recuperated. And then there was the question, are they going to come to Algiers? Am I going to get to Switzerland? Are we going to go to Holland or where? And so eventually, I was the one to come to America first at the end of 1945. And my mother and brother came 6 months later. They stayed in Switzerland for most of the time. And eventually, we were reunited. But I want to say one thing. In the early 30s, when Hitler took citizenship away from the Jews, I became stateless. And I was stateless for 20 years because I got my American citizenship in 1951, which was 5 years after I arrived, and it took 5 years to get citizenship then. So for 20 years, I was stateless. And what does that mean? That means you have no rights. No country has to admit you. No one is obligated to take care of you. That's what statelessness is all about.
Earl Harrison was the man who started, he was the head of Roosevelt's Immigration and Naturalization Service. He was the man who started the Crystal City internment camp. But he was a Quaker. He was a Republican, and he had housed German Jews with his wife in Philadelphia in the run-up to the war. Truman made Mr. Harrison his first envoy to the concentration camps in Germany, and he wrote a report which I detail in my book, The Harrison Report, which pretty much established our first relationships with what was then Palestine. Ironically, Laurie and I have been talking about the connections that people have in war that they don't know about. Ironically, Earl Harrison, signed Ingrid's internment papers to Crystal City and was there when she arrived. And only 2 weeks after Irene, Jacob, Werner, and Marie left the camp, he was there in Bergen-Belsen, and these were some of the Jews that were running the camp who told them what they saw. And he donated his diary to the Holocaust Museum, and the line that describes this, his 24 hours in Bergen-Belsen, and he was a very strong lawyer and a great humanitarian, but he said, these 24 hours in Bergen-Belsen have been the most depressing of my life, and I hope I can live through them. So this is 2 weeks after Irene and the Wolf family left. Here they are, just survivors, and I have a photo of Marie, but I don't have it up there. That's Jacob. Jacob settled in Brooklyn, and with his sister Marie and his father, and was quite a feisty guy. This is a plaque that exists at the concert, at what they call the Japanese Americans call all of the internment camps in America concentration camps. That's their terminology for it. This is Alan Taniguchi, who's the first man who ever told me about the camp, who was a very famous architect, and his father, Azumi, who was in the camp. And so I put that up there in honor of these great men. O'Rourke and his wife, Mary, stayed in contact with as many of the children from Crystal City as they came. And in his final report, he wrote that he hoped that there would never be a camp for families like the Crystal City camp, because he felt it was inherently unfair. And here he is at a celebration in Los Angeles with a group of Japanese. This is Ingrid. I just wanted to say a few things about Ingrid, because Ingrid and her brother Lothar, as soon as the Americans occupied Idstein, they got jobs with the Americans because they spoke English, and they were then able to feed their parents and their younger siblings because there was no food in Idstein. And they saved enough money to get back to America on a Liberty ship after about a year and a half. And they made their way to California, and Lothar was a very successful man. He is a very successful man. He joined the American military as soon as he could, became a fighter pilot, and got top security clearance. Eventually, which was odd because he always had to explain his childhood in an American internment camp. And Ingrid had a very hard time. She had been raped in Germany. She and her mother didn't get along. She struggled a lot. She did marry that guy who fought a German American who fought on the American side in Germany. But when they left the internment camp in Crystal City, everyone signed a document saying that they would never speak of the camp. And most of the people never did, because they knew what happens if you disobey the government, right? And so Ingrid felt very ashamed of her life because of the camp. And when I was able to give her her father's FBI files, which showed that he had done nothing wrong, that he was arrested because he was an engineer, she felt a lot better. And after I found out about Irene and the Wolf family, and I came here to interview Irene, I then went on this day to Honolulu to interview Ingrid, who was very, very sick at the time. And I showed her the list, and I pointed to Irene's name. And I said, this is Irene, and I had some photos, and I explained her story. And she stood there on that porch, and she just shook her head, and tears were running. She said, "Are you telling me that the people on this list, and that Irene was saved because of the 1945 exchange?" I said, "I am telling you that." And she broke into tears, and she said, "Well, at least something good came from all of this. At least something good." Because when you get to a certain age and you're looking death in the face, she died very shortly after that. And she so wanted to come to Ann Arbor to meet Irene, but she was just too weak. But at least her life had some sort of meaning. Her mother and father did come back to the United States, and they got they did get their citizenship. So I was astonished that in at least with the children of Crystal City that I interviewed, and I interviewed about 60 living children, and then all the rest. I haven't talked a lot about the Japanese exchanges, but it's in the book. I was just astonished that for people that were born in America, they don't see citizenship as a birthright. They were born here, and they stayed loyal to a country that it had in fact betrayed them. And they believe citizenship must be earned, and must be earned by working for some sort of personal cause. And so I feel that immigrants, there's a lot of immigrant bashing that happens in war. And whatever you want to call it, that perhaps these kids from Crystal City were collateral damage, I don't know. Perhaps they were scapegoated because of some hysteria, I don't know. But I do know this. This happens over and over and again. It's like the book of Job. Why do innocent people suffer? Because it's the way of things. It is the way of things. And I have, I always say, the book starts with a quote that Irene always uses, and I was so thrilled with it, about as I continue to contemplate how suffering can be managed. It can't be avoided. Suffering happens to the bad people as well as the good people. It can't be managed. And what Irene told me, and it's a quote that she uses sometimes in her talks, and I opened my book with it, and it's also a kind of a prayer or a plea for peace in the world, because she says, enemies are people whose faces you haven't yet seen and whose stories you haven't yet heard. And I will say that the great privilege of my life was to witness the faces of the characters in my stories and to hear their stories, including the story, the incredibly brave, amazing story of Irene Hasenberg Butter, Marie Wolf, and all of their relatives. So I thank you very much, and we have a few minutes for questions, unless, Irene, do you need to say anything else before questions?
Just open it up for questions.
Open it up for questions.
The internment of Japanese Americans is widely known.
Yes.
But I had not heard about the internment of German citizens or German-American citizens. Could you talk a little about that? I suspect I'm not the only one who was unaware of this.
Okay. The reason I think that we know so much about it is that the Japanese were arrested and evacuated on the basis of being Japanese. It was so bad that if you were like me, an Anglo woman, and I adopted a baby that was from a Japanese family, the government would have taken my baby from me. It was a blood issue based on the war hysteria of Pearl Harbor. President Roosevelt wanted and tried to get Francis Biddle, his attorney general, to also arrest all the Germans that he could arrest, that were legally here, first-generation Germans. And Biddle explained to him that if they did that, we wouldn't. I mean, there were millions of them, and they were running a lot of our factories and things like that. So that's when he gave Hoover the power to go after leaders or anybody that had any influence that might be of disloyal. The problem was that under the Enemy Aliens Act, You didn't have to do anything. You could be taken, and that's still the case with the Enemy Aliens Act. And so they created people that they suspected, but the evidence, they had an A and a B and a C evidence, and there was no trial, so it was hard to know. There were, no doubt, some saboteurs that were German immigrants, but they were never charged with or convicted of anything. And many of those people wound up in Crystal City. And the numbers of the people are not yet determined. Some people say, because there were a lot of German men rounded up and put in all male camps. To my knowledge, I have now personally found 52 American internment camps that had different things, either all male camps or family camps or whatever. So the history is unfolding.
What about the ones from South America?
Oh, yes. And see, one in the prisoner exchange, the Roosevelt was very, he had prisoner exchange on steroids. We have had prisoner exchange from every war since the American Revolutionary War, except Vietnam. And the only reason we didn't do it in Vietnam was because Hanoi would not negotiate with President Johnson. He wouldn't even give us the remains of our people in Vietnam. But Roosevelt really used it as his primary diplomatic tool to get Americans out. And you can understand why he would want to do that. So nobody can understand that better. But his job was trying to get high-value Americans out of Germany and Japan. That means businessmen, missionaries, and wounded soldiers. Those were his high-value things. And so he filled the camp with low-value people, like Matthias, this engineer from Strongsville. He really couldn't do any harm to Germany, but he was a low-value barter. It was human pawns. And so he was looking for even more. So he made a deal, the Good Neighbor Policy, with 13 different Latin American countries. And he told the countries that he would put military installations in their cities if they would arrest Japanese and German businessmen in those countries. So you had a lot of people from Crystal City who spoke Spanish because they were taken from these countries that FBI went down there. They had the blacklist, and the army boat came to the port of, like, Peru, and they took them to the port of New Orleans. And then when they got off the boat, they arrested them as illegal aliens, and they took them to Crystal City. And they traded a lot of those people. In that trade that Ingrid and Irene were involved in, there were several Germans from Latin America who spoke Spanish. So it's a crazy thing. Prisoner exchange is a very interesting topic because it's what I've now learned. I think that if you have an internment camp, no matter where it is, it exists in part for the purpose of exchange. And one of the reasons it's so hard to close Guantanamo Bay, this camp did not close till 1948, 3 years after the war was over. And part of the reason that was where were you, what do you do with people? Once you've captured them from other countries, what do you do with them? And so I hope I answered your question. Yes.
Oh, give me just a second to get to you with the microphone.
One quick question. You talked about Earl Harrison.
Right.
He went to the camps, Bergen-Belsen, whatever. Did he go to the camps during the war?
After the war was ending, right before it ended, he came 2 weeks after Irene left, and then the military, which was run by Patton, was telling Truman that everything was fine in the camps, that they were being liberated one by one, but things weren't fine in the camps, and Bergen-Belsen did not close until what year?
Well, it was liberated April 45, and then it became a DP camp.
And then it became a DP camp. And so he got before Germany surrendered, but we were winning. We had taken the area.
I am trying to find out When we were kids, we were told many things in America that I know now are not true. We were told that Roosevelt had no idea that there were camps and the Jews were being exterminated. We know now that he knew because survivors from Auschwitz escapes got to him through England. Is Harrison another one of those that he knew things weren't right and he knew that there were differences and Jews left behind and he did nothing?
I don't think so. I don't think so. He was a member. He was a very active in the Jewish movement. He was and I think he knew what was going on and tried to get as much attention as he could. It's one of the reasons he resigned as the Immigration and Naturalization Service, because he was so upset because there was not enough quotas for Jews to get them out. So I don't know. I don't know all of that. I do know that Roosevelt considered some very, I wrote about it in the book, he considered some very daring ideas, including the idea of bombing Auschwitz. While, as some of you know, who yes. know more about this, but he decided against it. And so at this point in the war, he clearly knew.
I have a comment and a question. From what you said,
yes,
I think it was confusing. I mean, Harrison couldn't have gotten to Bergen-Belsen till the Americans or the British got there, right? He wasn't there before the camp was liberated. Because as a U.S. military person, there was no way he would get there.
I think he was there before it was formally liberated. I think he was, because he met only with the people from the camp, and he was an emissary of the president.
Well, but we were at war with Germany.
Yes, I know. I'm not exactly sure, because you may be right, but I don't. But I know that he did not see any army officials in this camp. Okay. He did not meet with them.
The comment or question is to Irene. When I was in Bergen-Belsen, I mean, not as a prisoner, but visited, I was told that the British, because there was nothing there, and I was told the reason there is nothing there because the British burnt it because of the cholera and
epidemic.
So,
typhoid.
So I don't understand you saying that Bergen-Belsen didn't close till 3 years after.
Oh,
it didn't, because they made it a DP camp.
They didn't burn down everything. They burned records. They burned records, and they did burn, but they didn't burn down all of the buildings. Is that right?
Right.
That's right. Here he is in Bergen-Belsen. So.
And the DP camp was there for many years.
I'm wondering why Germany was so interested, why the Nazis were so interested in getting these German-American families back to Germany.
Well, there were several reasons. You know, it was a mixture of German POWs. There were German POWs. I think I gave you the number. I forgot it. There were German POWs, and then there were other people. And so they wanted people like engineers, because at this point they were trying to rebuild things, and they needed more people. And I think they were going to try, they did imagine, try to recruit the people that were the German men that came back. Matthias, when he got to Idstein, was arrested as an American spy and put into a Nazi camp, a Nazi cell for 3 months because he was, why were you in America? So there wasn't a whole lot of sense to all of this, and a lot of communication between, you know, things were falling apart in Germany, but they were trying to get Germans back to Germany to help with the war effort in any way they could. And the same for Japanese. It was much harder in Japan because so many American POWs were killed. The rate of death of POWs was so much higher in Japan than in Germany.
British, whatever, not kill them for change.
I don't know what your question is.
Why didn't the Japanese do what the Germans did? Keep the Americans who were in Japan.
I don't know, because I don't know the answer.
Why do the
I don't know. Well, it's a good question.
You mentioned...
It would have been more valuable exchange.
You mentioned General Patton. Mm-hmm. I've heard that after one of the camps was liberated, he and some other generals, including Eisenhower, toured the camp, and Patton took one look at the condition of the prisoners and couldn't take it, and ran behind a building to throw up.
I don't know. Yes. Any more questions? Yes, sir.
I think one reason why the Japanese internment is so much better known is because of the novel The Snow Falling on Cedars.
Yes, I agree with you.
That sold much more than any number of history books on the subject would have sold. So that partly answers the question and the comment of one of the persons here. Is there an actual novel or popular book on the German internment as popular as,
no,
say, Snow Falling on Cedars?
There's not. I agree with you. I think there's several things involved here with the Japanese. I think it was so shocking that you could just arrest so many people on the basis of blood that and that the Supreme Court, of course, late, and Ronald Reagan later offered an apology. One of the things that the German-American people that were interned, they aren't even recognized, have never been even recognized. They don't want reparations. But there is now a new movement among these people to try to get at least a recognition that they were interned and to try to find out the exact number. But I think that he's right. The Japanese-American community is very well organized. And they have got their material all together in these museums in a beautiful way. And they have a word called gamon, which is one way you endure suffering, is just to persevere. And they've had a lot of perseverance in the telling of their stories. The people that I talk to who were German-Americans are ashamed that they were interned, even though they were children and they bore no shame. They were, so that's it. But he's right. The literature of the Japanese internment experience is so riveting. And really, I have to say, this book is the first book to even begin to mine the German-American experience. And the German-Americans that were in these camps, some of them, like Ingrid, they felt bad about the Holocaust. I mean, they carry the shame of the Holocaust as well as the shame of their own internment. So it's a much more complicated situation that the Japanese-Americans have been able to retain their culture, while in effect, after World War II in the United States, a lot of German culture, they weren't allowed to listen to Beethoven or to Bach, and a lot of German culture literally went away. And so it's a difference in culture.
Do we have any questions from this side of the room? Right side? Oh, right there.
Thank you. This is a very nice presentation. I wonder what would be the right steps now, as we know there are this war in Syria and there are a lot of displaced persons. What would be a right place steps now, what to do from your experience?
You want to take that first?
It's a good question. I don't know if anybody in this world knows what's the right thing to do, except that countries have to take responsibility and have to be willing to admit some of these refugees and provide them with healing, first of all, because many of them have suffered tremendously, and then give them opportunities to rebuild their lives and to contribute to the societies. That's a tall order, especially in countries that have weak economies, but they're human beings, and they had to flee for asylum. So we're all human beings, and we need to think about what our responsibilities are to these homeless, stateless, deprived, poverty-stricken people who've lost everything.
I would agree with that. And one of the things that I have personally taken as a practice is that when terrible things happen, like what we're seeing here, with ISIS and these matters or during 9/11, it's easy to get angry. It's easy to get angry. But I think the best thing to do, or what I try to do, is to not make any decisions for my personal position out of fear, out of fear, and to try to make more deliberate decisions based more on what Irene just said. There's such an anti-immigrant feeling in our country right now because people are angry and they want to lash out at somebody, but why lash out at Syrian children? What good will that do? So I think we can be smarter, and I think we can learn from, World War II has kind of become a feel-good movie. Well, it's not always. Those of us who had some memory of it know it wasn't a feel-good movie. It was a tragedy. And Irene is living proof of it. It's easy for me to say that as somebody who's researched this, but you cannot deny it if you can look. We have personal proof. What if this story alone, her story alone, should remind us of what our humanity is? And it certainly has changed my life. And exactly what she said, if you have an enemy, ask. Maybe you need to talk to that person. And just maybe not tell them what to do, but just listen to their story.
All right, we have time for one more question before the signing. Would anyone like to ask one last question? Oh, okay. Oh, let me get to you with the microphone, sir. I'm sorry.
There was a Japanese unit, I don't know how large.
The 442nd.
Right. Where did those come from the camp?
Well, a lot of them came from the camp. And there were many young Japanese-American boys who enlisted in the 442nd from Crystal City. Sumi married one of them. And this was a highly decorated, the most highly decorated unit. One of the things that I found about the children in Crystal City is that they are uber Americans. They keep trying to prove their loyalty. And both the German American kids and the Japanese American kids. And they're terribly, they'll speak Japanese to each other or perhaps German to each other, but not, they really are try to be model Americans. And then their children kind of have a resentment of that. So it's interesting to follow it through the generations, because there was no such thing as post-traumatic stress syndrome as a word in World War II, although many of American soldiers had post-traumatic stress syndrome. Clearly, Irene, if she had it and didn't, and her mother and Lori's mother had it, and Sumi and all of those people had it, but they didn't ever know what to do with that word. And so they just tried to live their lives and be the most loyal, uberly loyal Americans that they could be.
Thank you
so
much,
and thanks to Irene for such a privilege. It's the chance of a lifetime to talk with her in front of you all. Thank you so much.
And for you, for writing the book.